Humility is an awkward virtue to teach, and one of the reasons it's so awkward to teach is that if somebody takes it upon themselves to teach somebody else humility, it's probably because they're trying to avoid the lesson for themselves. Because generally speaking, humility is a very hard lesson to learn. It's true self-knowledge. It doesn't mean having a low opinion of yourself. It means knowing who you are, knowing the gifts you have, but also realizing that they matter about this much. Not perfection, but zilch. And the reason being is there are many people with your gifts and talents, and they don't make you more special than anybody else. In the eyes of God, each of us are fundamentally equal. Which is why if Christianity permeates a culture, all of the posturing, gradually it stays, but it becomes increasingly ridiculous. We do have to have, in a sense, a stratified society on a number of different occasions, because you can't just say to somebody and say, well, we're all equal in the world of engineering, because that would be very dangerous. We can't all be equal in every area, but the quality or the value of the person is transcendent. It comes from God. Nobody can give it to you. The state does not give it to you. Mom and dad don't give it to you. Your friends don't give it to you. The degrees on your wall do not give it to you. Because the moment you think they do, we all start treating people who don't have these things with contempt. This is the real danger. This is why pride must always be under our little microscope of spiritual reflection. Because if the moment we start valuing ourselves for something other than what God has given us, it sounds nice first, but very gradually it starts to transform, and then it turns into some of the most subtle and dangerous of vices. And the reason why it's so terrifying is that a proud person will go to their death absolutely convinced of their own righteousness. This is where the self-righteous spiritual bigot comes from. This is where the persecutor comes from. This is where the tyrant comes from. They've lost the ability to go through spiritual introspection, and they're always looking at other people, why they're screwed up, why they need to be fixed. But the moment you say to them, have you ever, considered? And everyone knows exactly what this is like with their family members. Have you possibly considered that maybe in that traffic accident, you had something to do with it? And they just freak out on you. Anger is a sign of insecurity. If we are truly secure in the love of the Lord, that is where gentleness comes from. Because our throne can't be destroyed. That's how we develop gentleness of heart. Our culture tries to teach us to have gentleness of heart by having no convictions. And frankly speaking, it doesn't work. Because eventually, the fewer convictions you have, the fewer ones you have, you become incredibly militant about. So I mentioned last week, I think it was the 8:30 Mass, I have a tremendous respect for vegans. That's a lot of work. If there's any vegans in this room, I applaud you for your discipline, for your research and everything. That's not a slow clap, that's just like props. But then even if it's something very important, we also must be very careful that we don't judge people who do not see the world the same way. And this is a tremendously difficult thing. And you almost only find it in our Christian life. And the reason why we can see it is actually, the way in which we can see it is actually from today's saint. He gets the bump because it's Sunday. The resurrection always trumps the saint. But today we celebrate the feast of St. Augustine. Yesterday we celebrated the feast of St. Monica. And Augustine is one of the foremost saints in the church's history in terms of his intellectual or writing output. And sadly speaking, he's often neglected because sometimes his works have been misunderstood. One of the things that makes his writings misunderstood is that he's always incredibly suspicious of the visible, of the body, of a lot of things. And then he got a reputation later in the centuries about being a person who was excessively strict and had a very morbid outlook. And in some cases, his writing is a bit more morbid than most. But you can't just take the writing at face value. You have to look at the overall process of the person's life and then realize where he's coming from and why he says the things that he says. He was born in North Africa in the late 4th century, and it was soon after Christianity becomes not really becomes the official religion of Rome, it just becomes legalized. It's something that is tolerated. And you'll notice that one of the things that happens when Christianity is an underground faith, it's really easy to have an us and them kind of an attitude. It's really easy to grow in your faith when you're the underdog. It's really easy to have the boundaries of your tradition when somebody on the outside is pushing you. But the moment that the faith then becomes normalized, then we no longer have the outside pushing us and keeping us safe. The checks and balances have to come from within. And so St. Augustine comes in a period in which a massive amount of social change is happening in the Roman Empire, and it's crumbling. Just prior to St. Augustine's life, we have that famous Edict of Milan. Before the Edict of Milan, Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, the guy that legalized Christianity, he was not really a Christian. He was mostly a guy who had an idea of trying to unify the empire. He was more of a pragmatist than he was a moral or spiritual idealist. And he wanted to fold together this religion to be able to hold together his falling apart empire. He even broke up the empire into smaller little sections called dioceses. Actually, his predecessor did that. And then he separated the empire east and west just so that it was manageable. And he figured that this religion, this Christianity with one God, would be able to hold everything together. Sound familiar? We are a society that was built on empires. And all of a sudden, the reality check of human life is starting to get back to us. You can't control everything from the top. And so now we're having, in a sense, a breakdown of a lot of those things that we thought held us together. So just like in his own period, another thing is happening. The breakdown of relationships between parents and children. Monica, his mother, inhabited a completely different world than he did. It's analogous, but not the same as, to the fact that when you see your teenage or 20-something or even 30-something, you know, teenage kids or whatever, texting, and you're watching them do magic tricks with their thumbs, and you're wondering how on earth they're doing it, it's because they inhabit a different world. And the funny thing is that the questions, the fundamental questions remain the same, but the articulation is different. So Augustine grew up and he thought he was morally and spiritually superior to his mother. He wasn't, but he thought he was. And then he goes off on this long journey to kind of find himself. And it involves a whole bunch of screw-ups. He has mistresses all over the Roman Empire, and because he is an incredibly successful man intellectually and as a rhetorician, which is an ancient version of a lawyer, let's just say that he had tremendous clout. And it's very hard to stay emotionally and spiritually grounded when everybody worships the ground you walk on. And so he starts losing himself in this whole process. And later on, he admits in one of the most beautiful passages in his autobiography, he says this to God: "Late have I loved you, beauty so old and so new, late have I loved you. And see, you were within, and I was in the external world and sought you there. And in my unlovely state, I plunged into these created things which you made. You were with me, and I was not with you. The lovely things kept me far from you. Though if they did not have their existence in you, they had no existence at all. You called and you cried out and you shattered my deafness. You were radiant and resplendent and you put to flight my blindness. You were fragrant and I drew in my breath and now pant after you. I tasted you and I feel but hunger and thirst for you. You touched me, and I am set on fire to attain the peace which is yours." Because in the midst of his tremendous success, he was miserable, and he admitted it. In his autobiography, he describes seeing some beggars totally drunk out of their minds and having a great time. And he says, "Why is it that I have all this education? I have all this money. I have all this. And why am I so miserable to the point where I envy that guy?" He breaks down consistently in tears, and yet he doesn't know how to reconcile his disparate and confusing feelings. And then eventually he comes to this moment where he understands that although he says he longed for God, and that is true, but the images, the things that were coming to him, were keeping him from him. And one of the best lines in this book, one of the most quoted ones, is him just realizing that his prayers for chastity were not entirely sincere. He said, "Lord, make me chaste." He did this like every day. "Lord, make me chaste. Make me secure in your love that I don't need to be affirmed by anybody else. Lord, let me love you purely and with a sincere heart." And then he realized later, he added the addendum, "but just not yet. Let me just have the good times a roll just for one more day." A man that has everything is broken down to nothing. You can only expect that a man with that kind of wisdom, a man with that kind of experience, would be pessimistic about the powers of the world to fulfill the heart. It only makes sense. And this is where he gains the fundamental wisdom that changes the Western world forever. He says that all of human society, all of human agency, are governed by two loves: the love of self or the love of God. And that all culture, all life, all choices can be understood according to these two choices. But it's even more complex than it sounds. It's even more subtle than it sounds. Because just because people choose religion doesn't mean they're choosing God. Just because they're choosing civil service or family does not mean that they're not choosing God. His point is we must choose not the God we think, but the God that is calling us, that by grace is transforming us. And this puts us on shaky ground. We are no longer in control. That we are now the disciples that follow a God who guides. And that offends us. The more and more we realize it offends us, the freer we are. When I was preparing for the priesthood, I found this lovely prayer. It's called the Litany of Humility. And ever since, I've been praying it every single day. But the reason I started praying it every single day was that it angered me. Absolutely angered me. From the desire of being loved, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being affirmed, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being esteemed, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being humiliated, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being lost, deliver me, O Jesus. The one that really upset me, that others may be holier than I, provided that I become as holy as I should. And I read that and I was like, "Argh!" And the really funny thing was, is right when I expressed the anger, I also knew that I was theologically wrong. I knew that I was wrong, even though I was angry. All of my feigned self-righteousness, all of my purity, all of my thoughts of my own perfection just shattered. And then I learned something. We're disciples. And the reason why it's really, really hard to teach humility, and the reason why it's really hard to teach mercy, is because to truly know ourselves, we have to be in the right place. And you know, unless we're known, that doesn't work. And unless somebody is willing to walk with us, it doesn't work. And most of us don't want to learn humility in the sight of the Lord, and I get it, because they're always afraid that God is going to take them down so many pegs that there's going to be nothing left of them. And we have this relatively understandable apprehension, because why does God have to learn humility? Why would God even care? He's just trying to teach me humility, but he's just standing up there in his starry throne with his power, his control, and with his life and all that stuff. And yet I'm down here, and I've got to do all the heavy lifting. What's that? The cross of Jesus is the humility of God. We don't like people not appreciating our gifts. We don't like people not acknowledging how smart, how pretty, how capable we are. And look what he did. See what type of praise we give him on a regular basis. We ignore him. We show him contempt. We treat him as if money and power and control and praise, all these things are more important than him. He never gives up on us. He loves us with a humble, gentle love. He wants us to realize that he doesn't want us to worship him for his sake. He doesn't need us. He wants us to worship him for our sake. Because the more that we know that there is a God in heaven, the more we realize that you and I and all of us are all brothers and sisters. That no matter how many gifts I have been given, I am no better than anybody else. And no matter how poor and broken and destitute and addicted or lost or disgraced a person may feel, there but for the grace of God go I. Grow in humility and you will grow in grace. And not just in grace, but life will be more fun.